Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Nora Jones, and I am the Executive Director of the Partnership Project. We have no relationships to disclose. These are our Acura partners. The Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative is an 11-year partnership between the Partnership Project and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We are also partnered in our previous and current research projects with Cone Health, a regional hospital system based in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Partnership Project began as a community building organization, and after being introduced to the anti-racism analysis of undoing racism, it became an anti-racism training organization with the mission to educate community members and organizational leaders in understanding institutional racism and how to determine strategic actions to benefit communities. The Partnership Project led the development of the collaborative when they decided to focus on anti-racist systems changes in healthcare. The Partnership Project approached the academic partner at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and with an 18-month planning grant, established the collaborative as a CVPR organization focused on health disparities. The anti-racism training required for membership in the collaborative provides us with a common language and has been essential to the success of the collaborative as a partnership. What makes the collaborative unique is that it was created out of a community initiative. The community organized to look for and interview possible research partners to explore health disparities research. Our mission is to establish structures and processes that respond to, empower, and facilitate communities in defining and resolving issues related to disparities in health. We are a multiracial, multi-ethnic, and multidisciplinary group of about 25 active members who represent various neighborhood associations, hospitals, retired school teachers, college and graduate students, professors, and people from Christian, Islamic, and Jewish faiths. As we developed our focus on research, we decided to take the community-based participatory research approach, which allowed all partners to be involved in every step along the way, as you see from the slide, from the research question development to the analysis of results. Both of these guiding sets of principles, undoing racism and CBPR, help us to learn more about the root causes of racial disparities in health outcomes and health care. These principles are the foundation upon which our sustainable partnership was built and which helps us to maintain our focus of who we are.
And so this slide shows a little bit of what this is all about. And so at the time we were looking at areas to intervene, literally there were 1,000 different disparities: tooth loss, amputations, diabetes, hypertension. But we thought, well, what would really get people's attention? And the fact that that these disparities were occurring in cancer treatment, where in breast cancer, African American women weren't getting completed treatment, and despite a lower disease rate than white women, had a much higher death rate, and we'll show you some of those data. And in lung cancer, where African American men do not get lung cancer surgery compared to white patients, to the tune that the death rate is almost 50% higher. It's the highest death rate of any cancer group. And so, you know, people tell me, like, for heart procedures, well, maybe white patients get too many catheterizations. Well, with whether or not you get a catheterization, you might call that a gray area, but life and death isn't gray. I mean, you're either alive or you're dead. And so we started to make the argument for intervention along that path. So first, a little bit about lung cancer. This study by Peter Bach was published in 1999 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you can see that 13% gap of lung cancer surgery. These are early stage lung cancer patients, and the only cure in 1999 was surgery, and it's still the only sure cure, though radiation is a little bit better these days. But Bach controlled for everything: socioeconomic status, education, age, smoking status, all the things that you would want to control for in lung cancer. And this gap in treatment was directly connected to excess mortality. And then coming off this data, we've had this collaborative going now for over a decade, and so we did a prospective cohort study trying to figure out why this gap occurred. And what we found is that for African Americans in the gray area of medical comorbid illness, having other significant illnesses, the odds of an African American with two or more of these comorbid illnesses, like heart disease, like chronic obstructive lung disease, almost never went to surgery, whereas white patients still did. Whereas if you had absolute contraindications, that's when white patients did not go to surgery. And we also found that African Americans who did not have a regular source of care, think about it a minute, most lung cancers are diagnosed with an accidental x-ray. You go to the emergency room with a cough and then there is a nodule, so you feel pretty good. And so the patient is shocked with the diagnosis, and so when that happened to an African American who didn't have a regular source of care, there was no re-engagement, and the patient was much more likely to disappear into space. So the comorbidity and lack of regular source of care results indicate system-based variables that bias against treatment for African Americans, this idea of system-based implicit bias. Nobody did it intentionally, but the way the system worked, that's the way things have played out. And by the way, these data, you know, this study was published in, the first study was published in 1999. That gap has not changed to this very day with all the cultural competence training in the world. Breast cancer. This study was published by Silber in 2013 with over 7,000 patients. And as you can see, there's a huge survival gap between white and African American women. And with all these treatments, I mean, the differences are small, but everything trends toward less treatment for African American women. The study by Hirschman looked at the idea of, well, if you started chemotherapy, who finished it? And African American women were 34% less likely to complete their chemotherapy, and then in multivariate analysis, that was shown to be directly related to increased mortality. So in one of our studies, we went ahead and looked at cancer registry data to see if we could demonstrate the same thing in North Carolina. And what we found was that cancer registries don't even keep the statistic. They keep if you start chemotherapy, but not if you finish it. And so we decided that in terms of transparency, it behooved us to build an electronic system where we could find out who would indeed finish chemotherapy. So what we found in our work leading up to a cure is that cancer registries only show the start of treatment, not completion. In clinical decisions in gray areas in high-risk patients, non-African American physicians were less likely to take risk on African American patients. Again, not with an intentional bias, but with a systematic implicit bias. And so communication, attention to beliefs, and re-engagement over time are important for patients and providers. And so we put together the ACURE intervention on that basis. And so the transparency components, doctors didn't know their data. So we decided we needed to build a system where people knew data based on race from the past and then into the future. So that retrospective analysis that you see under transparency is whole cancer center data for the cancer centers involved. Then the real-time registry is this electronic system we built that took appointments from EHRs, x-rays, procedures, and if a patient missed an appointment, then a warning sign comes up that tells us to re-engage the patient. If the patient doesn't reach a milestone in treatment that we expect, then another warning sign comes up, except this time to re-engage the system and the providers. And so then this prospective analysis, we will not only be following data of people that are enrolled in the study, but again, whole cancer center data. And the last transparency component is the power analysis, where we do focus groups with patients who have been cared for in these centers, where we try and find out the pressure points, good areas where care was really helped, but bad areas where care seemed to be obstructed with barriers. And then the accountability components, a specially trained navigator who understands these issues, understands trust, understands religion, understands the patient model that's been expressed by Kleinman over the years. You know, we'll talk about those things a little bit more later. And then we do QI with the providers as part of accountability. We give feedback. Here's how you're doing. And we break the data down by race. And then finally, healthcare equity training based on principles of undoing racism and, again, principles of accountability and data. That forms the center, and we'll be discussing that in more detail later as well. So please write down your questions. We want to hold them till the end after the last presentation. There should be plenty of time after the last one where we can have, I hope, a robust discussion.
The first presentation this morning is on the power analysis and will be facilitated by Dr. Alexandra Lightfoot, Director of Community Engagement for the Center for Health Promotion and Disease Prevention at the UNC Gilling School of Public Health, and Dr. Jennifer Shaw, a retired physician who is on the executive board of the Partnership Project and a founding member of the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative.
Let's see, do we have to switch to another? Oh, you got it.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm Jennifer Shaw, and I want to just bring your attention to this set of pictures. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the difference between equality and equity, but I want to just point out that that's what we're trying to look at. If all of these kids had the equal opportunity to watch the ball game, some of the kids aren't going to see it. But if we can change from that model of equality to a model of equity, everybody gets to see the ball game. And that's what we're trying to do in our work. We have no relationships to disclose. I want to start by just briefly talking about what the Undoing Racism training is about. That helps frame our project. It's an intensive two-day training, and all of the members of the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative, everybody who's involved in the ACURE project, undergo one of these two-day trainings. And it's divided into phases, beginning with an exercise that tries to help people think about shifting paradigms and looking at things from a different window. The next phase really emphasizes historical and present relationships between communities and institutions and develops a visual diagram of the power relationships between communities and institutions. The third phase involves learning exercises about gatekeeping, accountability, and how that relates to internalized racial oppression. The fourth phase looks at race and racism and how race and racism manifest in our institutions from a linguistic, cultural, and individual viewpoint. And then the last part looks at how institutions impose their values and cultures on communities that they serve, and issues of internalized racial superiority.
So you saw this slide a few minutes ago, and I think now, having heard this description from Jennifer too, you can hear the language that's interwoven in our intervention. Today we're really what we're talking about is the power analysis piece of this intervention, and it is an important step because it links together our transparency and accountability components, because it helps to inform the healthcare equity training about which you will hear a little later in our talk.
So, in the Undoing Racism curriculum, the power analysis is used to encourage participants to examine structures of power and privilege that hinder equity in our systems. We've taken this tool in ACURE and adapted it to use the knowledge and the expertise of the patients who are within the system and the healthcare workers who are within the system to analyze how the structure of their specific system functions, and to focus on the systemic issues that might hinder ability for patients to continue and complete their care.
Another aspect of our work that you've heard, you saw the slide with all our partners on it. How do we get to this power analysis? It involved all our partners, community partners, academic partners, medical center, cancer center partners. So the first step in our ACURE power analysis was to conduct these focus groups that Sam mentioned earlier with cancer survivors from the two cancer centers who are our partners. We conducted 8 focus groups with black and white and breast and lung cancer patients. And the focus group guides, just like every step in our process, were developed by a group of volunteers from the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative. The questions on the guides are based on that previous study, the breast cancer study that you heard about a little bit too, CCARES, Cancer Care and Racial Equity Study, with input from Sisters Network Greensboro, which is an organization of African-American breast cancer survivors. And this was the local organization of that. And the purpose of the focus groups was to elicit patient perspectives to help us really understand these systemic barriers, again, as Sam was saying, but also facilitators. What encouraged them, what discouraged them from continuing their treatment for breast cancer and lung cancer, as you can see by these questions here.
So one of the things that happened when we started talking to the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative as a group about how to do the focus groups, the suggestion came up that we needed a visual diagram for the patients to look at to try and talk about things visually as well as just conversations. So with the help of members of the collaborative, some medical personnel, and again, the Women and Sisters Network, we, through many iterations, developed this diagram. Now, each time I present it, people from the audience have suggestions for how it could be different. Let me tell you, we worked hard to get where we were with many voices involved. But what we want to represent, show you, I'm just going to briefly talk about it. On both sides, the community is really important. And we wanted to start and end the journey in the community. Along this side, we have the word suspicion. Sometimes breast or lung cancer patients start with suspicion. Sometimes they don't. Their primary care doctor may be involved. It may start with a screening test, a chest x-ray or a mammogram. There may be the necessity for, they may come in based on symptoms or some kind of a mass. And then the next step in the journey is going to be the diagnostic process, and that's going to be different from depending on what their situation is. They may need more testing, they may need referrals. And one of the things that came up over and over again, both in the CCARE study and in our conversations with survivors, is the phone call or the visit when they find the diagnosis of cancer. And that is an extremely important thing. So we wanted to explicitly include that so that that would be talked about by the patients in the focus groups. So then we go to the treatment arm, and the treatment may involve surgery or almost always involves surgery, radiation oncology, medical oncology, and then all the other things that happen in the cancer center, all the other different components that might be involved. And then lastly, there are things that sometimes happen that are unexpected, other kinds of experiences. Emergency room visits are very important, complications that people get into. What happens with telephone calls, support groups, all those kinds of things we wanted them to be able to talk about. And then lastly, what happens in follow-up as they go back into their communities. And this was a diagram that we used then in each of the focus groups. The steering committee for the ACURE grant came to the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative with an initial draft of a plan for how to do the coding of the transcripts once we had the transcripts. For those of you who've been in the collaborative, it's a very interactive group. There's a lot of conversation, and nothing ever just slides through. So there was much conversation that went on about how the coding should work. And the decision was made to develop paired coders. And the pairs were always a person of color and a white person, always an academic and a community member, but also taking into account people who were insiders to the system, outsiders to the system, people who were had really powerful voices and could possibly suppress the voice of somebody else if they, so matching personalities. And then lastly, trying to look at people who'd been in the collaborative for a long time and really understood the history of the collaborative and people who were newcomers to the collaborative. So we tried to balance all that. Then there was a training session that was on focus group coding that was conducted with the entire collaborative. And what happened is we had so many volunteers after that meeting that we ended up with, for each transcript from the initial set of transcripts, two coders, two more coders, and then the four of them coming together and having a conversation. What we discovered after that first set of transcripts is that was really overkill, that two voices was enough. And so for the second set of transcripts, we had the two coders for each set. And then as we were going along doing the coding, we would come back to the collaborative with what findings were emerging from our data, present it to the collaborative, have conversations, and then more suggestions came up for different ways that we could look at the data. So it was an iterative, inactive, active process the whole time.
So another way that the collaborative is really key in developing our process is that in bringing the first round of emerging findings, we really wanted to draw on this whole notion of pressure points. And that, again, grew out of a technique that was used in the CCARE study, critical incident technique, that was used in Army Air Forces to understand specific behaviors that led to this, either the success or failure of an air mission. So kind of using that lens, we then, a small team, again, of community, academic members, people with experiences of cancer, people with experiences of working in the healthcare system, got together to really even more deeply analyze the codes from the transcript to understand from the stories of the patient perspectives, what were the pressure points? What were the moments when they chose to continue or discontinue their treatment, and what were their experiences that really critically influenced that decision? So this was a very intensive process, and it really brought around, you know, kind of what the pressure points were. And again, we just want to recognize that there were so many people, and there are a lot of people in this room who are involved in this process, community partners, academic partners, medical partners. And then everything we do, we then bring back to the broader collaborative, just in case, to involve them in the next step decisions. So what did it look like? You saw the original cancer journey, and now this is what the cancer journey looks like when it's been, the pressure points have been identified. And as you can see, the little marks in green are positive experiences that patients had in their encounters with the cancer system. The ones in red are negative, and the yellows are kind of, you know, neither positive or negative. And so this is what it looked like once we had coded and really looked through the places in the cancer system where patients had pressure point encounters. And to go even then beyond that, cancer survivors, basically you could see there was a lot of green on there. They had a lot of positive experiences. These cancer centers treated them. So they had lots of good experiences in their experiences. But you could also see there was a lot of red, too. And so we were really trying to figure out what those red pieces mean. They said, across the board, they said they didn't feel like they were treated differently because of race. However, by using this power analysis process, what we saw was that they did have differential treatment. And that's what the power analysis process allowed us to diagnose, basically. And so this slide kind of summarizes our findings of what structures in the cancer care system, you know, compromise Black patients' quality or completion of care. I mean, you can see there's some similarities and some differences across the two cancer systems. Similarities around communication challenges or delays, and some around pain and side effect management. But then there are also differences around flexibility regarding treatment, perceptions of interactions with providers, and attitudes. So again, this, what we're doing now is using these findings to help us build this healthcare equity treatment to help providers and staff kind of change the way they do things. So this tool has been incredibly effective, both to help us examine and analyze the structures within the healthcare system from the perspective and experience of patients. And the resulting map has helped us really kind of document, really hone in and pinpoint what those pressure points were. But it's also helped us kind of as a partnership and in our research aims to kind of achieve transparency and accountability amongst ourselves, but also, you know, kind of in the what we're doing in the research study. And again, it's helped us to kind of move forward our research aims to try to bring about changes in the system through our healthcare equity training. So thank you.
The next presentation is Healthcare Equity Training, an Anti-Racism Tool for Enhancing... Hey. A little bird told me that the patient navigator and physician champion as partners in addressing racial equity issues in cancer care, Dr. Lynn Robertson, our site lead investigator at the University of Pittsburgh, and Karen Foley, who has served as our nurse navigator in the Pittsburgh cancer care system.
you can see, this is a slide that was previously presented, but we're showing it again because it's to be fresh in your minds, because it pertains to much of what we're actually going to discuss, based on the two components of the intervention, the transparency components with the several analysis and real-time registry warnings, and the accountability components with the Acure Research Navigator, exploring and responding to barriers, utilizing the real-time registry and clinical feedback reports, and health equity training with booster sessions. We have no relationships to disclose.
Whoops.
So we have, you know, you probably are all familiar with the fact that there are all sorts of navigators within varied responsibilities within throughout many healthcare systems. So what is so special about an Acure research navigator? Well, he or she is seen as an enhancement to usual care by serving as a two-way bridge in communication to optimize accountability in care. This is done by applying undoing racism training and communication counseling techniques in search for delineating barriers based on historical case studies. Possible examples of those barriers may be lack of trust or atypical attitudes such as hyper-religiosity or even possible fear of air exposure to cancer. Uncovering these barriers are done through multiple methods of being proactive with regular patient contacts, which we'll talk more about, and determining the effects of power analysis to pressure points results. So how is an Acure navigator accountable? Well, with no diffusion of responsibilities to others in the case in the care system, the Acure navigator not only promotes understanding and adherence, but also takes what is learned back to the system. For example, if the patient perceives a barrier or has a concern on policies or procedures that they may have had or are currently encountering, then the Acure navigator there is there to advocate for the patient and engage the system, not only be a messenger of the system. So this is the Cancer Care Communication Educator Protocol, and the purpose of this is designed to engage patients. So unlike usual patient navigation that tends to be reactive in response to non-adherence or admissions in care, the Acure Navigator aims to be more proactive at the onset of care with the goal of addressing questions and concerns raised by patients before the break occurs. The protocol designates that visit one will be done either after the initial visit with the doctor or within 72 hours of that. During that visit, the navigator reviews the treatment and hears how well the patient comprehends their plan of care using the teach-back method and how the patient feels about that plan of care, so assessing health literacy and trust. These talks then serve as an adjunct to the doctor-patient discussions by answering questions that the patient either felt unable to ask or did not think of within the duration and constraints of the physician appointment. More importantly, the Acure Navigator participates in active listening regarding the patient's concerns and, with the use of the teach-back method, confirms what the patient actually heard and understood from the doctor-patient interaction. So visit two is 10 to 14 days later and is more for open discussion, answering any patient-related questions or concerns they may have at this point. If indeed at any point between, during, or after these visits there is lack of understanding, patient concerns, or could benefit for any further visits, then these are arranged as needed. If at any time the patient does not show for an appointment, then the Acure Navigator works to assess through patient conversation if there's any mechanistic barriers, such as transportation difficulties, insurance issues, or even maybe childcare issues. And if not mechanistic, we'll then assess for fear-related issues. Maybe there's fear of treatment, the system, or something along those lines. If not fear-related factors, then assess for trust issues, such as disbelief of the diagnosis or potential diagnosis, perceived disrespect, or perceived racism. The hope is that by going through this process that we will identify reasons to stop hindering of care that can then be worked out with these patients. So in review, as stated earlier, and is very important, the ACURE Navigator is accountable. Again, since all responsibilities cannot be diffused to others in the care system, based on no or limited understanding in the dialogue resultant from the teach-back approach and or identification of barriers, the ACURE Navigator not only serves in the role as the advocate, but also engages the healthcare system to find solutions to those existing barriers. In addition to this, the ACURE Navigator will elicit patient suggestions to reduce the impact of negative experiences, and then will communicate that back to the Cancer Care Center. So these are some examples of identified barriers. As you can see, system barrier, I was told that I would be called from patient scheduling, but it has not happened yet. So the ACURE Navigator addressed this with patient scheduling, saw where the breakdown occurred, rectified the problem, and then the patient was called. Lack of trust. Due to poor past experiences at this hospital, I'm afraid to have my surgery done here. This patient was more of a challenge because he had tremendous overwhelming fear coming in for treatment due to the loss of several loved ones dying in that hospital. This patient, through several discussions, ended up getting the treatment that he needed after he was given options. So the last one, and I don't know where our little title went, but it was an example of atypical attitude. I'm not willing to be opened up because when air hits cancer, it spreads like wildfire. This one requires more of an education, trying to dispel the myth believed by the patient by talking to them about the biology of cancer at their level. Resolving this meant re-engaging the physician and then having more of an explanation on this.
Now moving on to the real-time registry. The real-time registry actually creates transparency as the patient's adherence to appointment is monitored, as well as the system's function in having the patient reach milestones of care. But needless to say, we're working with two systems. There was no current database in either system that could produce these types of reports that we wanted. So we worked very hard to evaluate cancer registry data, current electronic medical record data, and a variety of other types of data, realizing that in both systems, that data was not always accurate. For instance, many times race was missing. And in particular, it was not in real time. So we set ahead and started to develop the real-time registry, which is housed actually in North Carolina, but it is an integrated database that we have created out of a multitude of systems. Now, in order to accomplish this task, we had to define parameters of care using structured data that can be pulled by automatic reports. We also had to determine a therapeutic starting point, which we set as the date of pathological diagnosis. And also, we had to incorporate definitions of effective therapy so that everything was the same across the system, so that as an outcome, we would then have the real-time monthly reports or quarterly reports. Now, this may be difficult to see, but this is actually our outcome measures. So this denotes the breast and lung cancer treatment outcomes, and it defines the various outcome measures for both breast and lung cancer. So just as a couple of examples, for stage 1 or 2 lung cancer, a milestone is reached if the patient receives 3 out of 4 recommended cancer treatments. We'd love to see all 4, but if they do 3 out of 4, that's great. Breast, the milestone's reached if the patient receives 80% of their recommended chemo. With lung cancer, we say they've reached the surgery milestone if they've had their surgery within 4 months of diagnosis. And it goes on so that you can see that the outcomes are defined. Now, so what does the navigator have to do with all this? The navigator is accountable. So the navigator is accountable for 2 types of messages. If the patient misses an appointment, then the emphasis is on serial communication and re-engagement with that patient and exploring, as Karen went over, where barriers may be occurring. Also, if the patient's keeping appointments, but we notice on the report that milestones are not being reached, the ACURE Navigator accountability involves approaching the caregivers in the system to explore reasons for the milestones not being reached. But you have to remember this is a healthcare system, and many times there's a hierarchy there, and you're dealing with physicians. So that's why the physician champion is very crucial, because the physician champion works collaboratively as a partner with that navigator, and very often it's the physician champion that may have to address the other members of the healthcare team. So as you can see here, this is an example of how the reports work. So we had a patient that attended the breast multidisciplinary clinic, and she came and she met with her medical oncologist, the surgeon, and the radiation oncologist in 1 day, which is nice for the patient because that all happens at once, but it's a lot. It's a lot of information. During that appointment, she received her treatment plan, which included starting on a neoadjuvant anti-hormone therapy before her surgery. The ACURE Navigator received an electronic warning from the real-time registry to give the patient a follow-up call after the clinic appointment. And as you can see, the navigator did that. And what the navigator realized was that the patient reported she was doing well, she had completed her scheduled MRI that morning, but when she reviewed the scheduled appointments, the patient actually had a conflict with the upcoming medical oncology appointment. She also reported that she had not started on her drug because the pharmacy was waiting on authorization. So the navigator let the patient know she would get back to her and then proceeded to interact with the financial advocate, and Aetna approval was obtained so that the patient could start on her drug. She also worked with the medical oncology scheduling person in the office to get an appointment that was acceptable, and then she called the patient back and delivered this information to the patient, and then also made sure that they understood that if they had any further questions, any further concerns, that they could call the navigator back, and she made sure that the patient had her contact information. Now, with the physician champion, we're working with physicians, and we want to make sure that they understand their role, so we did develop an ACURE Physician Champion Guide, which provides them with an understanding of their leadership role, their responsibilities, and their needed contributions as an integrating collaboration companion with the ACURE study. So the physician champions are on board with this study at both sites. We have 2 physician champions at each site, 1 breast, 1 lung. And their role is to support the project in the cancer center, support the ACURE navigators, provide bi-directional feedback through quarterly clinical performance reports, and help implement any action plans. As I said earlier, the navigator and physician champion work as partners, so they both serve as patient advocates throughout the system. They're partners in advocacy at organizational meetings. They're co-planners of the health equity training sessions at each site. And the transparency component is their partners in data feedback for the cancer center providers, which comes from the RTR and other prospective data sources. Thank you.
Hey, who'd you say was next? Okay, this is healthcare equity training, an anti-racism tool for enhancing accountability for cancer care equity. And this will be presented by Dr. Eugenia Ang from Gillings Global School of Public Health and Christina Hardy, who is the project manager for the ACURE trial, MPH from UNCG. Somebody she knows is out there, was a professor of hers. Thank you.
Okay, so this is on healthcare equity training and anti-racism tool. No disclosures. So I want to start by talking about the challenge of actually why healthcare equity training is necessary if we take a systems approach. And so although U.S. medical schools and healthcare institutions have mandated nearly universal training programs in cultural competent care since 2001, this approach has fallen short in helping providers assess and address the stark realities of inequities in their own institutions, fallen short in understanding their impact on patient care, and falling short in helping them gain the tools to combat inequities at the system level with the goal of improving patient outcomes. Despite lack of evidence on the effects of implementing culturally competent care, healthcare organizations that receive federal funding are actually mandated to provide staff with cultural competency training. So to move the field beyond interventions that are aimed at surface level understanding of diversity or multiculturalism, concerns have been raised about whether cultural competency training itself, which uses a kind of a categorical knowledge-based approach, may in fact promote provider stereotypes and biased behavior when interacting with minority patients. So although considered a systems-level approach, culturally competent care has not specified a mechanism for holding individual providers and their institutions accountable for eliminating inequities by race and ethnicity in optimal care and medical care.
And hi, I want to say I'm honored to be in place of Dina Hayes Green this morning. And so to represent her work, to share with you, because she was instrumental as a trainer for the healthcare equity training, I share with you that the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond was founded in 1980 by two longtime community organizers, Ron Chisholm and Dr. Jim Dunn, who realized that in order to effect change in historically oppressed communities, they needed a fundamental understanding of why are people financially poor. They came to realize that in order to change and uplift communities, it was necessary to address these three things: racism, culture, and history. It was necessary to address systems and the way they function. They developed the Undoing Racism training because of the need to create strategies to develop wholesome communities, not to develop programs, but to develop communities. And I want to recognize we have some People's Institute representatives with us, Dr. Kimberly Richards. So I'm glad you're here with us. The People's Institute received the Unsung Hero on Sunday night. And so we have, as was shared earlier, adapted the models and the components for the healthcare equity training. For session one, we have used the exercise in the shifting of the paradigm by showing the video Bad Sugar on how damming of the Gila River caused diabetes among the Pima Indian tribe. Also in the first session, where there was an examination of historical and present relationships of institutions within communities, we presented 7 years of retrospective cancer registry data from each cancer center on race-specific standards of care and showed a visual description of power relationships within each cancer system. So for the first booster session, where from the Undoing Racism training, there should be a focus on examining transparency and accountability. For our healthcare equity training, we presented and discussed findings from our focus group interviews with current patients to show race-specific pressure point encounters in each cancer system for managing treatment side effects and pain. for an upcoming booster session, we're planning to examine and define race and racism by looking at the manifestations of implicit bias within the healthcare system. And finally, we want to also identify institutional impositions of its values and culture on communities they serve and examine internalized racial superiority and inferiority. So the planning is ongoing.
So in taking a CBPR approach for actually planning and evaluating our healthcare equity training, we have a planning committee. And you can see the diversity of the planning committee always. There are members who are from the clinical staff at these two centers, as well as academic partners and our community partners. And to accommodate the clinic schedule, we meet at 7:30 in the morning or at 6:30 in the evening. It's been essential to have us all together to actually reflect on how this content should be delivered, but also who would be the best facilitators to actually deliver the content. Also for publicizing and recruiting to get staff from these two cancer centers to actually attend. It's not mandated. It's not mandatory, I mean. But and these two cancer centers are very different. At Cone in Greensboro, there are 250 employees, whereas at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, there are 450 employees at the cancer centers. Pittsburgh is a teaching hospital associated with the university, so they have grand rounds. Cone does not. They have a tumor board, whereas Cone has, we have like lunch and learns as well as other kinds of structures, town hall meetings. And so how do we build these healthcare equity trainings into kind of these opportunities that are within the structure? For evaluation, we have three instruments. One is a participant survey questionnaire, which has 15 items, eight of which are used Likert scales. We have an observation checklist, which is completed by collaborative members and some of our staff, and they're just three open-ended items. Were there questions or comments during each particular session? Who participated in this discussion? What was the tenor of the discussion? Did the time seem adequate? And then finally, we had debriefing interviews with the actual presenters of that session. And it was conducted as a group by Alex, who is one of the co-investigators. And it had four questions. What about the training went well? Was there anything that didn't go well or seemed challenging? How can we improve? And how do you think the training was received by participants? Okay, and this is kind of a screenshot of how the we sent out, they were saying, to all the staff members by email. And this is the actual flyer that we used to seeing the invisible. As you can see here, the different times that we had structured in there. This has been a very difficult way of trying to really reach the diversity of people who read their emails and who actually open their email messages and read them. We would love to have each healthcare equity session have a mix of physicians as well as nurses, social workers, you know, radiology techs. You know, we really want people to see themselves as a team. But so much of it just depends on who reads these, and we've been coming up with different other kinds of strategies, but this is the one we're using so far, and it seems to be working. Okay.
And so after each question, as she mentioned, we had debriefing sessions, and this is what we've heard from them. During each session, who was present in the debriefing included the trainers, observers, physician champions, or nurse navigators, site directors, project manager, and then facilitated by the process evaluator. And so what we found out that went well was that it flowed logically. The people in the room felt it flowed logically. It was non-threatening. The Pima Indian case created a safe space for discussion because we were working on an oncology issue, but we were talking about diabetes. So that created a safe space to not feel challenged. Dialogue on cancer journey diagram was helpful because it was very interactive. And it was sometimes out of the norm for the normal cancer center staff meetings. There was a perfect amount of data presented. So these are some of the benefits. What can be improved? Be clear on the source of data. Emphasize takeaways for messages of what to do between sessions. And then create ways throughout for eliciting comments and questions. So there's more engagement all along the way.
So those are the perspectives of the presenters and now the perspectives of the actual participants. So these are responses to the Likert scales, and so one being strongly agree to five being strongly disagree. As you can see, the participants at each cancer center pretty much agreed that overall the first healthcare equity session had enhanced their understanding about how their own system of cancer care is generating treatment outcomes that are race specific. The items that received the highest scores at both cancer centers, one was that it really introduced well the concept of implicit bias. Two, that it expanded their knowledge of what is health equity, not just disparities. And raised their awareness about outcomes of patients at their cancer center. However, there were differences with regards to the lowest ratings. At Cone, participants were predominantly nurses and social workers and other staff, gave lowest ratings to discussing a strategy for increasing equity that Cone Health can implement, lowest ratings to awareness of how specific procedures and protocol systems within Cone Health that can improve their interactions with patients and colleagues. At University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, participants were predominantly physicians. And they gave lowest ratings to conveyed information that will assist me in improving the health of patients, understanding of the power associated with my role and responsibilities within University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Here are some participant comments, open-ended, that to the question, in what ways do you plan to use the information presented or ideas for the discussion to improve outcomes for patients? At Cone Health, I think my awareness is heightened more about difference. I understand that this may be unconscious. I look forward to hearing the real-time results and learning how each of us can make a difference and understand what that difference is. At Pittsburgh, they said, I consider the environmental challenges that patients face. I'm aware of racial bias that may influence me subconsciously. And a second participant said, additional attention to the cumulative expenditures associated with treatment, such as parking and copay. So at Cone Health, we have completed one booster session. The boosters are 3 months after the initial healthcare equity training session. And this just shows comparison between the at Cone. We will be doing the one in at Pittsburgh in a couple of months. So the highest ratings were given for, it raised my awareness about outcomes of patients at Cone Health, strengthened my understanding of Cone Health's role as a leader in working to increase equity in the health outcomes of cancer patients, and the content was relevant to their practice or role at Cone Health. The booster session reviewed the findings from the retrospective data. It also discussed race-specific findings from the power analysis encounters with the management. So this might give rise to why these were the results. The comments that they gave for the booster session was, when patients complete radiation, there is a 2-week and 4-week follow-up appointment, but with skin problems especially, maybe we should call them after 1 week to check the status of their treatment healing and how they are doing. Another comment, we should pay more attention to what is being said by patients and their unspoken concerns. Watch their body language. And another comment, we need to ask questions to gain a better understanding of voice concerns.
And so in conclusion, a CURES healthcare equity training is a good start. It's a good start to engaging staff at two centers. Our partners are shifting the current thinking about mechanisms that cause racial health disparities. And that is the mechanisms of changing patient-provider interaction through cultural competency, because cultural competency is necessary, but it's not enough to close the gap. Through healthcare equity training, the CURE is introducing the two system level mechanisms to cancer center staff through transparency by presenting their cancer center's own data, but analyzed by race, to reveal their own history of inequities and standards of cancer care, how not receiving these data by race in real time has functioned to make inequities invisible, and then two, through accountability by eliciting and monitoring data from their own patients to reveal how race-neutral treatment policies and procedures are affecting race-specific outcomes, and also by identifying system-level innovations for enhancing and monitoring equity in cancer treatment outcomes. Thank you. All right. Okay.
the last paper is how a CBPR partnership developed the capacity to implement systems interventions within medical centers, organizing co-learning and trust among partners while addressing racial equity and cancer outcomes. So you've heard a lot about accountability and transparency and the way that's fit into interventions, and now you'll hear a little bit about the relationships and some of the good and good, and that'll be presented. You've met Christina Hardy and Beth Smith. RN MSN is our Acure Navigator in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Okay. So this discussion will be about how the partnership is developed and managed to cover all of the interventions that were discussed previously. And in our title, we discuss capacity building and developing capacity. And by that, we mean the processes through which systems and individuals and organizations obtain, strengthen, and maintain capacity to set and achieve our own objectives for all partners over time. Okay? And we also want to share with you how this is a growing process. We grow more mature as time goes on because we get to know each other better through that process. Okay. So this is a model of our community academic medical partnership that was constructed and exists in the context of the larger society. So we are and were responsive to the federal proposal that asked for an innovative approach to address health disparities. So that's part of the context of this. We also are and were responsive to the cancer survivor community who wants to hear and demands for better outcomes for cancer research. We're also responsive to the community organizers and activist community and the public and the general public who demand social justice. So this is the context of our partnership coming together. It was just shared earlier also how the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative formed itself in that context. And in the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative, that set the foundation for the ACURE steering and leadership structure. So on the one side, you'll see UNC Chapel Hill and the Partnership Project had the initial community academic relationship that expanded, reaching out locally to the Cone Health System, which is in Greensboro, and then it expanded to reaching to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So all of that was the foundation for how our structure was designed. So this is a model showing the leadership structure and how within ourselves we are accountable to the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative, and that's why that is the overarching parent, if you will, to the ACURE leadership structure. So within the ACURE steering committee, we have several subcommittees. And so they all have opportunities for community, academic, and medical partners to work together to carry out the work of the project because we are using the community-based participatory research approach. And so just briefly, the publications goes over, helps to make sure we have a presentation to the public through press release. The navigator search, we included cancer survivors to help find our wonderful navigators. The healthcare equity training, we just discussed, we have two different planning committees for the different sites. In the informatics, we have a whole team of specialists in both settings to plan for that, so that's a cross-site collaboration. In the process evaluation, we have the most complex system where for the survey development, that was also a team of community and academics working together. Within that, we have a whole system of interviewers who we love and adore that are helping to carry out the interviews with the cancer patients. So it's not only academia who are delivering the interviews, but our community investigators as well. Focus group analysis is as a composite group, as well as the navigator communication analysis. So some people ask, what kind of environment do you have at your meetings to create such a safe space for people to feel comfortable to have this open dialogue? And so this is what we do. We have monthly meetings where we have an agenda. This is a picture from one of our meetings. We share research updates, and we share updates on community organizing for those who are helping to bring people to an understanding of racism, the structural racism. And then we also have updates from our cancer support groups. And so it was during one of these committee, one of these monthly meetings, where we gave to the community updates on how many people were recruited into our project by race, and then how many people were withdrawn by our project by race, because this is what we had to report to our university offices. However, during the meeting, one of the community members asked, well, how many people are refusing to join the study by race? And so that was a different type of accountability than what we would have been held to had we not had our community partners. So they helped to keep us on track with our ethics, because that also indicated they understand the history of mistrust within the African-American community. It came to find out after we did our number crunching that there was not a difference by how many blacks refused to join as did whites. And so that is a benefit of having this meeting every month. So to keep our task going on a frequent basis, we have weekly conference calls with the steering committee. Also, they're led by an agenda, and we give updates on participant recruitment and intervention planning. And it is at these meetings where we get to share challenges or ask questions so you can get ideas to think outside of the box to handle them. So for instance, people can ask questions such as, how many times is too many for interviewers to continue trying to reach participants after to take the telephone survey? Also, what other ways should our nurse navigator try to communicate with patients who refuse to return calls? Also, who should we work with in order for the hospital to make attending the healthcare equity training a priority? So these are the kind of discussions that we have on those calls every week. The subcommittee environments are very similar. They're held at early morning or late in the evening. Majority of them are by conference call, but initially the first session is face-to-face so that all the participants know who they're working with. And then during collaborative meetings is where you have the opportunity to sign up to join these subcommittees. And so the overall, talking about partnership capacity development, in order to participate in this kind of research and to have access to the data, you had to be certified by the university to deal with human subjects research data. And so we have an alternate opportunity at UNC Chapel Hill where our principal investigator can deliver the certification in a more informal manner, but it is allows the certification to occur. And this also helps with everybody understanding how to protect the confidentiality of the data of the people that we're working with. And so that was the way that we developed capacity of everyone to work on this project. Also, we have co-learning opportunities inside and during meetings. So outside of meetings, we share articles with one another that are relevant to our study. And then inside of meetings, we've had opportunities to discuss situations like, what do we understand about colorblind? And what is the goal for the medical institution on using that term? And so those are some examples of us learning together.
We continue with opportunities to build our partnership capacity by learning directly from and volunteering alongside of cancer survivors, such as with the Sisters Network that you see here on this slide. As mentioned earlier, the Sisters Network is a national African American breast cancer survivors education and support group. The picture on your left is one of our meetings where our North Carolina State Senator visited the meeting and updated us on efforts our state is making to improve outcomes for breast cancer patients. The other picture is from the Sisters Network Block Walk. This was an educational event where we volunteered to be on teams that went door to door in a Greensboro neighborhood to provide education about breast health and to encourage them to come to the local community center for a health fair where breast exams and other screenings were performed and to visit with local community resources. At the beginning of our project, the principal investigators from UNC Chapel Hill traveled to each site to meet with various individuals in order to establish trust, a shared vision for how the research activities would be implemented, and to develop a good working relationship with our partners. In Greensboro, they met with grant administrators, with doctors, with office managers from the offices where we recruit our patients, with the nurses who take care of the patients, with other clinic staff, and with the cancer unit teams, which included multidisciplinary teams that are our breast and lung cancer working groups. There were several benefits of arranging and developing our partnership in these ways. First, we have a clear vision and opportunities to ask for further clarity among research staff during our weekly steering committee calls and with our community partners at monthly meetings. We have a pool of community researchers from the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative who have a great understanding of what is happening with our research participants because they conduct the quarterly interviews. Our project manager, Christina, is a traveling liaison who sees the medical research site activities and the research analysis activities weekly, which facilitates understanding across the sites because she is able to learn about it and communicate it to the relevant staff members. And there's also the opportunity for all members to participate in additional research activities if they desire, which promotes diversity in researchers. So there are also some limitations and some challenges. Funding cuts prevented more cross-site visits, which limits the steering committee's understanding of site variations between complex medical systems. The impact of rigid financial guidelines around disbursing funds by UNC on our small nonprofit community partner would mean that they had to go into other pots of money to keep the project sustained. There were additional expectations of the navigators in order to build trust and to be seen as part of the team, such as assisting with patient follow-up and assisting with facilitating cancer conferences. There were unplanned additional expectations of community partner consultants' time to help develop and implement research plans or evaluation analysis. And there was a delay in meeting with relevant site experts because the healthcare system complexity required time to identify who needed to be at the table, such as who in the IT department could best help us to get the needed information from the electronic medical record for accurate reports. It also took time to know what physicians would be good physician champions. And then there were also some staff changes with the loss of a physician champion and a nurse navigator who each had to be replaced and each had to attend the two-day anti-racism training.
And so, and just in conclusion, it takes so much to develop a partnership to be able to carry out this very important and sometimes controversial work. So it was through trust-building activities, collaborative methods, using this approach to research that's collaborative in nature, knowing and continuing to further our understanding of anti-racism principles, and then having the opportunity to have open discussions about this in our monthly meetings. Also because of the frequent communication channels and the subcommittee structure and through the community organizing, these are the things that helped us in this project. And I would just like to conclude by saying that I wanted to dedicate this opportunity to present to you today to my mother, Cassandra Dolores Hodges Young. She was a breast cancer survivor and passed at the age of 60 prematurely. And she died in 2006, 1 year before she was to become a grandmother. And so I thank you for this opportunity today.
So you've heard about these interventions, and I can tell you that the early data look promising, and hopefully next year we'll be able to show you some real hard numbers of what's happening as a result of these multi-pronged interventions. And I can tell you that forming an electronic system from what amounts to six different electronic health record systems, if you can do that, you can do anything. And if you can get physicians to attend health equity trainings, you can do almost anything. But I want to thank all the presenters. And before I open up the floor for questions, I just want to say that this session is sponsored by the Community-Based Public Health Caucus. Please visit our booth at 1046 in the exhibit hall or go to our website at cbphcaucus.org, and the floor is now open for questions.
Phenomenal person. I mean, well respected by his patients road we were going down, at least at Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and what, at the beginning we only had one champion at each site, but we've realized that each organ system treatment has become so specific that we really needed to get one of each. Sir. Well, first of all, this study is limited to stage 1 and 2 patients, okay? So it eliminates the idea of late diagnosis causing deaths. These are all, we specifically decided to focus on early stage cancer patients, so again, people wouldn't focus on, well, that treatment wouldn't have cured them anyway, because in stage 1 and 2, the treatments are all curative. And everything we've done, all the data we've shown, are controlled for age, comorbidity, insurance status, education, all the things that you know, that you would think would make a difference. So all those things are really accounted for. So it really comes down to, do the physicians make the recommendation? Do the patients accept the recommendation, and does it happen?
Let's see. I will start with you in the black. Yes.
Thank you. How did you identify the patients for the study, the clinical research study that you're doing? Because I understand that you're going into the community and you're working, building relationships with
Christine.
Okay, sure. We are recruiting at the clinic site, but we're actually recruiting on the initial diagnosis.
recruitment is on lung cancer, a lot of times you can't get a biopsy before somebody actually goes to surgery. So we actually have a validated calculator that gives us a probability based on the characteristic of the patient's CAT scan and PET scan results and some of their age, their smoking status. And so if someone is now 80% or higher on that calculator, they qualify for the study so that we discuss the surgical decision before they go to surgery. There's no retrospective stuff on surgery. Well, which race-specific changes?
Well, rank order, I'd say, by the most significant, the less significant.
The 300, just the 300.
Yeah, so our data analysis is three-pronged, okay? We have the qualitative data from the focus groups. We have the 300 patients who actually signed consent who are in the real-time registry, but since we're with the health equity training and the fact that, one of our goals is not only to educate providers and workers at the cancer center, but to inspire them and in some senses make them paranoid. That we always have to think about doing the right thing. We can't knee-jerk this implicit bias, so we are also following whole cancer center data over time, and we have it going back to 2007, and so we're doing a time series analysis looking at the slope of the line of treatment of the entire cancer center.
By race.
But are you?
What are you finding from that?
We're early. We're just beginning now. I would say next year we'll be back. Because we're still tracking it.
All right.
I really enjoyed the presentation, and it's really exciting the work that you're doing. It seems very cutting edge and really exciting. And so, obviously, when it's exciting and innovative, you want to spread.
So there's something called the Affordable Care Act. And in the Affordable Care Act, there are quality of care measures. And so cancer centers are being pushed to come up with a defined quality of care system where they measure the kind of things that we're measuring. So we're going to use that alignment in order to spread this work. And, there's also, right now, CMS, as well as AHRQ and the CDC.
Can you say those words?
No. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, and the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, or some people would call it the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But anyway, those three organizations are really pushing the envelope now on measuring by race, and part of stage two of meaningful use is to make sure you have race, ethnicity, and language data on at least 80% of your patients. And so again, I also work in the electronic health records world, and so in order to get 80%, you got to build a system to get everybody. Okay, and so anyway, things are trending to where we're going to have to measure. We'll have to measure by race, and we'll have to do something.